Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind, a program meant to bring you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And it seems that here on Election Day in New York City, what better programming than to talk about the heart of things, you know? It's really the heart that makes all the difference in the world. And we were just lucky enough to hear Majid Ali and his guest talking about some of the factors that affect the heart, including environment, nutrition, and so on and so forth. And almost by magic, he and I were working on the same wavelength, because Plan to be with me today is a chief cardiac psychologist, Dr. Austin Hayes. Cardiac psychologist, what is such a thing? Austin, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's an exciting thing. So we're going to talk about cardiac. And here's what it's about, you know. Cardiac psychology is about how you could deal with, well, describe it.
The study of cardiac psychology is really, or the idea of cardiac psychology would be the relationship between the mind and the function of the heart, how we perceive the world that we live in, how we see the world and ourselves in the world, and how that might affect our heart function.
Now, and, you're talking about the health. Physical heart function, not the heart like you're in love heart.
Yes, physical
right?
heart,
you're talking
how
about
it reacts,
heart.
The reactivity of the heart.
You're connected up at Albert Einstein, at Mount Sinai and a
yes.
couple of other places, and physicians go to you and they send people to you.
Yes.
And you don't want any more patients, so you're on. Just don't go running to her. She'll give you names of other people. Mm-hmm. She's loaded. Because everybody falls in love. No. Because people have heart attacks,
yes.
people have clotting, people yes. have arrhythmias, people yes. have a whole bunch of things, heart failure. There's so many things that could go
or
wrong.
Or even with hypertension before they've had a cardiac event.
And with the proper mental set, mm-hmm. we believe you're not going to be, number one, you're not going to either get the heart attack, or number two, you're going to be able to recover better.
Yes, in terms of not having a heart attack in the first place, there are so many variables involved in predicting whether or not someone may have a heart attack. And about, if we think about what you inherit, you know, from your parents or family members, that really accounts for about 10% of cardiac disease, but about 80% is lifestyle. So whether or not you smoke, how you eat, whether or not you're sedentary, and then also how you deal with stress, how you deal with the emotional aspect of your life. And so it's a significant part of
Is there another 10% coming?
Actually, there's another 10% that sort of, no matter what you do, you probably won't get heart disease, and we don't know what that's all about. But
matter what you do, you won't or you
well,
will?
Well, you probably won't. Probably won't. I mean, we're accounting
it
for...
It could be your relationship to God, you know, and if you... Or something
actually,
like
religion
that.
Is also... Also, something that, in general, with health, has been found to be something helpful, but it's true.
So we have 10% heredity.
Yes.
80% environmental
lifestyle.
And lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
and 10% karma, or something like that. But let's talk about karma, mm-hmm. because karma, people see that there is a definite difference between your mood and what comes out of your mood. And I think what you're saying is there is a predictable lifestyle that is going to be the most likely to have a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a mental set that right. is. Can you describe, right. is it the type A's that
probably
are going to have
the
heart attack?
Probably first, the type A is not a term that's so much in favor today, but we still see that personality. That would be the person who's very, you know, typically highly competitive, tends to be easily angry, hostile, cynical. Perhaps aggressive, either verbally aggressive or physically aggressive. So that would be probably the person that we see repeatedly prone to develop cardiac disease.
It's the guy who's the Wall Street magnate who's up on top of the world and he's screaming, buy it, sell it, and he grabs his heart and he falls over.
Well, could be, but there's another point to make, that what the studies tell us would be that people who are on top of the world, for example, the CEO, he's very much in control, may be less likely to have a heart attack than the person who's more of the middle manager. The fellow at the top has a lot of responsibility, but he also has a lot of control. The fellow in the middle has a lot of responsibility, less control. The fellow in the bottom is less likely to have a heart attack, again, if we're talking about control, because he has no responsibility and no control. So too much responsibility and little control can be a bad mix in terms of developing heart disease.
I think you're saying something very important, Austin. Too much responsibility and not enough control over your environment. So we mix the two.
Yes.
We have helplessness, which is powerlessness.
Yes.
Mixed with some kind of frustration, you know, and all this responsibility.
Definitely.
A wise man I once knew, he said if you could combine those two things, you combine powerlessness with frustration, and you have the key for depression.
Yes.
He said this is, and you're saying, yes, it's the very same key.
Well, it can be,
that works
yes.
for heart failure and yes. heart conditions. And remember, we're talking about physical heart conditions. Dr. Hayes is a psychologist, but works very closely with the physicians who treat and the physicians who deal with heart. And in fact, you've started a web program.
Yes.
To give people information, and in case you can't listen, the name of it is?
Is www.thegoodheart.com.
Let's talk about people who are most likely to get heart conditions, heart failures. You're saying,
yes.
So one is...
Well, again, the person who tends to have a type of personality where there might be more anger or cynicism, people who are not necessarily trusting, who sort of don't trust the intentions of others. So there is this state of arousal that they experience frequently that means that the whole body is in a state of arousal and there's constriction of blood vessels and so on and so on. So all of these things contribute to over time or can contribute to wear and tear. Another possibility would be, although not as high in numbers, but people who have anxiety are or possibly at greater risk for developing cardiac disease. If a person is depressed, we find that if, for example, someone walks into the doctor's office with the hypertension, for example, and they are diagnosed as having cardiac disease, if they are also depressed at the same time, the depression becomes the predictor of a cardiac event within 12 months after that diagnosis.
Oh, wait a minute now. A guy goes in to see a doctor. Doctor says, hey, you got some weird stuff going on in your heart. If you're depressed, you're more likely within 12 months
to have a cardiac event.
Having a cardiac event.
Yes, which could be anything. Could be a heart attack, could be bypass surgery, might be a stent, a need for a stent or stents, might be death. Could be that.
So I'm very impressed. So within 12 months.
Yes, it's
depression, therefore, seems to be one of the most critical things to look for.
Yes.
You talked about anxiety. You know, I know type A personalities, and I know people who are effective. The ones who are effective, who get things done, they go on a higher speed, but they're not necessarily nervous. They're not anxious. I think the kind of anxiety you're talking about, Austin, is the kind that is a combination of excitement and fear at the same time. There's an apprehensiveness. There's a nervousness, like a Woody Allen kind of nervousness.
Yes. Yes.
That I think is more likely to be than just somebody who's high energy.
Absolutely.
Because people with high positive energy, you know, even if they're manic, I wonder if they did a correlation between bipolar disorder and heart attack. Do you know?
I don't know, but my sense is that you'd think they don't have it.
I think manic people don't, but I think the depressed part of them do.
Well, we don't separate the person.
During the time of manic?
Well, I couldn't say that because again, if they're in a state of arousal, just realize that if they have the cardiac disease to begin with, if it's there, then anything that leads to this intense state of arousal is likely or possibly going to lead to a cardiac event.
Intense state of arousal could be...
Again, if you are manic, you are in a high state of arousal.
What about running a marathon?
that's a high state of arousal. But it depends, then again, how fit is the person, even if they, you know, they may not have heart disease or cardiac disease to begin with.
We hear so many stories about people who are in a perfect, perfect condition.
Yes.
Who are they're people who run all the time, they exercise all the time,
yes.
they go to the gym all the time.
Yes.
But there's something intense about them, and there's
yes.
an intensity about them. Then here they drop dead of a heart attack.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
So health isn't enough.
It's not everything. It's being able to run a marathon is not the total protection. It might be you might be actually exhausting the heart. Again, depends on the individual. These are very individual choices, and I think that everyone should check with someone before they decide to embark on training for an event such as a marathon. Because even if you think you're in the best health, there may be something that the doctor sees that you would not have known about.
This is Armand DeMille. With Dr. Austin Hayes, we're talking about cardiac health. And we're talking about the psychology of cardiac health. I mean, it kind of makes sense. Mm-hmm. If you're happy, you're less likely to have a heart attack. You think that's true?
People in general who are more optimistic, people who tend to be more positive, are less likely to develop disease, and if they do develop disease, are much more likely to recover more effectively and more efficiently, more quickly. Than a person who is, for example, depressed. So being positive, being a happy person, as you're saying, I don't know if you even have to be happy, but at least positive and optimistic is a protection.
Or we could say at least not negative and pessimistic.
That's right. That's right.
The corollary
right.
of it, which is that That's if right. you're negative and pessimistic, mm-hmm. you're more likely to have a heart illness. I mean, it may be, you know, I mean, heart attacks may be just a stroke of nature's wisdom saying to you, you know, you're such a miserable creep, let's stop your heart until you feel better.
Well,
you know, maybe it'll turn you around because you can't keep going the way you're going now.
Yes, yes. Well, there. If you think about depression, depression is very often an endpoint for intense stress, prolonged stress. So there are some who would say that perhaps it's the body's way of saying you've got to stop. You can't continue the way you are. But that's, again, opinions and theory, and I don't know that that's borne out in anything that we can rely upon. But certainly depression is often an endpoint of chronic stress. Very often in the rehab program at Mount Sinai, when I have a group, very, very often there will be a few people in the support group who've gone through something, some sort of loss that occurred in the 2 years prior to their cardiac event. So they were dealing with something for a long time, perhaps taking care of a loved one who was dying or losing a spouse or losing their job, losing financial stability. All of these things you'll see if you start asking questions that very often the endpoint is some sort of cardiac event. So chronic stress can be very dangerous.
Is this an open group?
Yes.
What kind of an open support group is it?
Well, it's for persons who actually have had some sort of cardiac event specifically. And we have a couple of groups. We have a Wednesday night group, and we have then a once a month. That meets weekly, and then we have a once a month group that is typically people who are there at rehab, participants in the rehab unit.
So there's one that's special, and then there's one that's open, which is the,
that's correct.
The open one is the Wednesday night one?
Yes.
So if you're somebody out there who's had a cardiac event and you want to meet with other people and have a support group with Austin Hayes and her fellas.
Yes. Yes.
People around you, right?
And support is enormously, enormously important. Part of the reason, again, if we think about, we're talking about emotions, but emotions and actions or behaviors are connected. So, for example, if I'm down, I'm less likely to take my medication. I'm less likely to want to exercise. So my behavior is affected dramatically. So when we have support, we see that people stick to their program. So they're much more likely to do well as well, partially because of that support.
I have a theory about support groups. Mm-hmm. And I know Dr. Neil Schachter was on the air with us teaching us about pulmonary stuff, mm-hmm. and he's got a support group. In fact, he's got one meeting this week, I think, on Thursday. They've got an open support group for people with lung disorders or whatever that is, pulmonary stuff. But, you know, one of my theory about groups mm-hmm. is that all of these groups, including Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, all the support groups, they do something. I think part of the reason that people have such trouble is because they're missing a sense of family. If there were a sense of family, I think you're probably less likely to have these disorders because you would feel safer in the world.
Yes.
And I think one of the things that the support groups, the 12-step groups, what they do is they give you a sense that you belong to something. And that creates family, in effect. And in effect, just it's the family itself, the sense of family.
I think it's very true. I think it's very
true. Of course, that's just theory, and it would probably take a lot of testing to prove it out, but who wants to prove it out? It just seems to make sense.
Well, if I may report, this is not a new study. This was done, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, but it was a study of primates in which they had two groups. One group was what they called a stable community or a stable social group, and the other was unstable. And those in the unstable group, and unstable simply meant that every 3 months they introduced new primates into the group, that after 22 months, the members in the unstable primate group had developed cardiovascular disease, whereas the stable, those in the stable social group had not. So one of the theories on the reason for this development of cardiovascular disease was that each time a new member was brought into the group, the existing members had to sort of reestablish dominance. So I think that if we think about our lives here every day in America, we're reestablishing our position constantly. You know, if it's just that you're trying out a new job or you've lost your job and you have to get out there and try again, whatever it may be, reestablishing dominance day after day is going to, again, there's that state of arousal, protection. We become more defensive. We become more vigilant. We become more worried. So the family unit that you're just referring to would act as a buffer, whatever family means, as a buffer against the world, against the universe. And we do have a loss of that for many people. We're a very mobile society, so many people are alone.
Belonging to something. How about the survey? Have we any of the surveys come back and proven people in family tend to have less heart conditions than people not of family?
I can't say that, but I can say that people who have support at home, for example, a spouse who's supportive, they are going to do better than people who are isolated. In other words, they don't necessarily say family or no family, but isolation is actually considered a risk factor for heart disease.
You know, except in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in a hospital and you're in a cardiac rehab, one of the things they try to do is keep the mate out of there. Because part of what the mate's anxiety very often triggers the illness, it makes it worse. Do you know anything about this?
It may, absolutely, yes, yes. It depends on the mate. It depends on the relationship. There is a lot of dynamic going on between a husband and wife, for example, not just in the hospital, but when they go home. The husband very often is fearful of telling his wife anything, even if he's just having a little discomfort, because the wife may become so anxious, so he becomes her caretaker. On the other hand, the wife may be, or the husband may feel that he's overburdening the wife. I mean, there's a lot that goes on. And if we can, we try to understand the dynamic between the couple, not just the individual.
And, of course, there's nobody there in a hospital to watch that much. I mean,
no,
we don't have a staff to say, evaluate the mate.
Right.
So they keep nice, brief visiting hours.
Yes.
And they kind of say, Probably is helpful. Let the guy be alone. Let him relax.
Yes.
Let him find his heart somehow. Okay, this is Armand DeMille. We are doing some interesting stuff. Now, what could you do about your mind? Let's say you are worried. Let's say you say, I had a heart attack. I don't want to have a heart attack anymore, but I'm worried, and I'm negative, and I'm depressed.
Right.
What are the ways of dealing with depression?
Well, there are a number of ways, and actually one thing that is very, very hopeful is depression is treatable. It's very, very treatable. There are a small percentage of people who don't respond to treatment. But there are a number of ways, and one might be psychotherapy, and that might be sufficient for some. They might be medication.
Just having some
medication.
And that goes back to the family,
Yes.
A good psychotherapy or being able to go into your office and talk to you is like finding a sister or finding a mother, or finding a friend.
I hope so.
And so when the person talks to you, they feel a little safer, and that relaxes that heart muscle, you
definitely.
Know?
Definitely. Safety. You keep using the word safety, and it's a great word. It's a very, very important word. Safety.
So that's how psychotherapy mostly will work, by letting you know that there's somebody out there who cares about you and understands you.
Exactly. Who'll listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be one choice. And the other is, if the doctor, the therapist, or whomever it is you see, sees that the therapy, in fairly short order, if they see that it's not sufficient, then the medications for depression today are actually safe. We find that they're safe for the heart. That is to say, so far we don't see any complications for some of the antidepressants.
Some of them, not the old ones.
Well, not the old ones, but the newer class of drugs are actually helpful. And in a study that was done here in New York, when they gave a particular drug to cardiac patients who were depressed and had had heart attacks, those who had the medication actually did better in terms of recurrence. And the thinking was it might have actually helped to thin the blood just a tiny, tiny bit. So that's an area that's not my area, but in terms of the medical aspect of that. But certainly, if you think about reducing the stress or reducing the intensity of the depression, again, the body is allowed to relax a little bit. Because when we're depressed, it doesn't turn off. Even when you're sleeping, the effects of the depression are working on your cardiovascular system. So sleep doesn't even relieve the depression.
Well, if you've got a negative mind, or let's say you've got a phobic mind.
Right.
And you have a phobic mind and you say, all right, now what we're going to do is, let's say we can't medicate it and therapy doesn't necessarily work by sitting and just talking to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're somebody who's phobic, and by phobic I mean you have a terrorizing fear mm-hmm. of people.
Okay.
And as soon as you get in a crowd, you feel panic and you don't know what to do and you have this panic kind of feeling. I mean, you can't just tell a person like that, change your mind, change your attitude, and this way you'll have a better heart.
That's a good question. Actually, you can. But it's about when you ask them to do that. So phobic responses are very, very treatable, again, with cognitive therapy and very successful treatment. And it doesn't typically take that long either, which is good news. But what you would do in a case like that is you would determine exactly what it is, what are the triggers that the person responds to in terms of their phobia. And then ask them, you would do this in your office, you would help them deal with that trigger.
Well, let's use an example so people can see.
Mm-hmm.
How about a person's afraid of cockroaches?
Okay, well.
Now what are you going
to
do?
I would ask them to get an exterminator, perhaps. I don't know. But
you don't want cockroaches in your office. I could tell.
No. So,
no, you would have them visualize
real,
a cockroach.
You might, actually. And you would certainly discuss, you would want to know what the history of that, how that developed. And indeed, that if it had some experience, if they had some experience early in life, it might be a very real fear that is, very valid. But we consider that learned. It's a learned response. You weren't born fearing cockroaches. So you learned this. So now we want to unlearn it. And if we think about learning, we can unlearn through basically desensitization and then ultimately exposure. So you might ask the person down the road to expose themselves to a cockroach and be in control of that response. So it can be done.
See, it happens again. And it goes back to what I'm saying about family
mm-hmm.
in a funny way, because when a person who's got a phobia, when you have phobias, you feel so alone.
Yes.
If you're afraid of dirty hands or something,
yes.
And you're afraid of dirt and germs,
mm-hmm.
and you come in and you could talk to somebody about it. It's right away you've got somebody in your family who's saying, yes, I understand, yes.
And you don't have to be embarrassed or
ashamed.
You don't
have to be embarrassed. Let's talk about it a little bit, and let's go into it. And you could talk about it freely, because otherwise in the world you can't.
Right. And these are very common. These are not uncommon in our society that people have. This goes back to the beginning of time that people have had phobic responses. And talking about it and realizing that there are, millions of people out there who have the same type of responses, for example, the hand washing, helps you not to feel so odd. And that's in itself therapeutic.
We're speaking with Dr. Austin Hayes, cardiac psychologist
mm-hmm.
who works with people who have had physical heart conditions and helps them either in recovery
mm-hmm.
or helps them through information, which is through the website as well, and helps them through running groups. And is Gear giving us information and not drumming up business, which is what I like about all the people at Mount Sinai. Don't send me people. Just, I say, come on, give my audience this information because we need information. Tension, and this whole idea of worry. Mm-hmm. I mean, here we have two people in the world, you know. One person is worried, and the other person lives right next door and has had the same experience, and they don't worry.
Yes.
Worrying is a pathological condition.
Right.
It's a pathological symptom, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's hard for people to believe that. They say, oh, no, what about me? I mean, I live right in the... But, you know, there's two people could come from the same litter.
Yes.
Right? And one will worry and won't. One, right. Two puppies. You could have a nervous puppy and you have a not nervous puppy. Mm-hmm. Worry will kill you. Worry is going to cause that heart to break down at some point. I guess almost it changes the odds significantly, doesn't it?
Well, I have to say that... there isn't a huge amount of research on worry, but again, if we throw worry into the catch-all of sort of being in a stressful state, and that's or anxiety,
like
calling
or
it anxiety, it's under the heading of anxiety. We know that anxiety and any one of the negative emotions, anxiety, depression, anger, a stress response, whatever that might be, each of those are related to the development of cardiovascular disease, and each are needed for survival, which is kind of a contradiction. We need these emotions. They are telling us that there's something to be aware of. But it's really just that if they're triggered too frequently, too intensely, or they last too long, that they become problematic. We're never not going to have some anxiety or some anger or some frustration. We need these emotions. Anger can be a motivator. Anger can be an energizer. But it's the person who's angry too frequently or too intensely, too much of the time, that is more at risk.
But each of these, depression, anxiety, I know we could lump them together, but I think they work differently. Because let's just take a look, since you're a psychologist and we've had similar training, let's say you take a look at two different forms of depression.
Yes.
You have a person who's depressed, and then you have a person with an agitated depression.
Yes.
We're going to say the person with the agitated depression is more likely to have a heart condition than the person with just a...
Not necessarily.
It would almost make sense.
Well, you know, in the very beginning, when I say beginning, many, many years ago, when we were looking at, and of course now I say we, but it goes back 50-some years ago, looking at anger
and
hostility.
Before you were born, I understand.
But then moving forward, when they started to really pay attention to depression, I remember thinking, I don't understand this, because people don't look as though they're in a state of arousal when they're depressed. Quite the opposite. They look very lethargic and withdrawn. But as it turns out, from an underlying mechanism, a lot of the same thing is happening, whether you're very angry or you're depressed or stressed, in terms of the physiology of the responding of the body.
Well, we're going to talk about the physiology of the response of the body, exactly how the blood works with each of these physical conditions, which seem to lead to why is it that there's failure. When we get back from our break, we're going to be right back, and when we come back, a little music from Eric Reed, who wrote a beautiful song from my heart. We'll be right back with you. Thank you. Prelude in E minor by Debussy. Oh, by Chopin. I'm sorry, that's Eric Reed. From My Heart is the name of the album. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind, WBAI, if you just tuned in. Yes, we play good music. But yes, we are the station of choice. We are the place where you can learn more about good things related to your mental health, your physical health, your environmental health. And here, today we are talking with Dr. Austin Hayes, and we're speaking about the heart, the physical heart, that actual instrument inside your body, that thing, that muscle, that it seems to run so much. And we've been learning a lot about it. A little earlier, Majid Ali was talking about it, the environmental aspects of it, and the different aspects. And we're talking about this. Well, let's talk about meditation for a minute. You know, they say part of the thing is if you're a little too spaced out, you should do meditation and you should relax. There's been some positive correlation between heart health and meditation.
Fairly recently, it was found to lower hypertension, so very effectively. And another good finding was that it seemed to affect insulin and to the good. So we are become less insulin resistant when we meditate. So calming the body again does seem to have a very positive effect. And the muscles and the arteries are going to be more relaxed, so it kind of makes sense.
So basically, relax is a good idea. But you see, mm-hmm. I think there's another approach to this, because I think what I've seen with people who succeed, people who meditate tend to remove themselves more from the world, saying that the way I'm going to find my peace and quiet is in my isolation. And I say the following. I say, meditate with your eyes open. Don't close your eyes. Be a part of the world when you meditate so that you can include the world in your meditation so you don't have to go off somewhere and close yourself down in order to find peace in your heart, number one. And number two, be in contact with people. Try to do it where you're in contact with people, because I think what meditate, I've seen many people who meditate to a point of health, but they're very, very depressed and very tense. So it doesn't necessarily, I mean, it's not the answer that it seems to be, even though it seems clear that many people would benefit from it.
I think you're making a good point, but I would also say that the person you're talking about or people you're talking about might be too intense, even with their meditation. That is to say, they're taking their health and their lives a little too seriously. So I think that meditation, I'm a big believer in meditation, but I think it should not prohibit interaction or interfere with interaction or connectedness to people. I think that if it allows you to be very alert and connected, then you have the best of both worlds. But sometimes people, you see them taking everything. They're meditating and they're eating this diet or that diet and they're exercising fervently and they're doing perhaps a little bit too much, so they're not really connected to people or with people.
Is there such a thing as too much exercise and too much?
There can be, absolutely. It seems that there can be. There may be, a point of no return with exercise. And again, I think simplicity, balance, moderation. With all
what
things,
happens
very important.
When people have a heart attack, mm-hmm. is there a familiar kind of mental set that people have? Do they get scared of things like afraid to have sex?
They may. They may, absolutely. That's actually common. That's a very common, most booklets on what to do after a heart attack include those questions about sex. So the fear is that if you're getting that heart rate up again to some high, you know, until you've learned what your limitations are, which takes a little bit of time, and what you can do, people will be frightened.
Well, how do you know when your heart is at a threatening point when you're having sex? I mean, see, your heart's beating mm-hmm. fast, it's beating fast, it's beating fast.
Right.
That's part of what having sex generally is, isn't
right.
it? Unless you're having sex while you're meditating, which means
right.
you're having it alone.
I think that there is the standard question that or answer the doctors give, which is if you can climb two flights of steps or stairs, then you are able to have sex. But I also think that if you listen.
Oh, wait a minute. How about if you could have sex twice in the morning, then you're able to climb a flight of stairs?
You might not be able to climb stairs after that. I don't know.
Okay, let me go back. I know I'm just fooling around. But the question is the following.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk specifically about sex. Sex is a heart rate riser.
Yes.
Now, if you've had a heart attack, now you're afraid of when your heart's going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? I mean, is it? Do we have a number? If you wore a little heart monitor, could you tell? Oh, my heart's going over 110. Now I'm in danger.
You can. And again, a lot of this is about education that you get, perhaps in your doctor's office, or what I always recommend is cardiac rehab. I think it's extremely important,
mm-hmm.
because they monitor you after heart attack. You're wired up, so to speak, and
they put you through
connected
exercise
to
programs.
Machines,
yeah.
Exactly, and they'll let you know, and they'll come to you and say, you know, slow this down, raise this up, and you leave that rehab program understanding what your heart rate should be. The other thing is that very often I recommend to people, if it's not recommended by their doctor, that they get a heart rate monitor that they wear for a long time. I also think it's interesting to wear a heart monitor when you're out in the street. If, for example, you miss the bus, look at the heart rate monitor and see what happens. Are you reacting or overreacting to a missed bus? And once you've been given a number that is a healthful number for you, a good number for you, then you might be overreacting to certain stressors.
What's the simplest heart rate monitor a person can carry around?
I mean,
do you have one you put on your wrist?
Yes, exactly. And there's a little band around the chest, perhaps.
But let's say you leave out the one. Can't they do it just from your fingertip? Don't they get your heart rate from your fingertip?
Well, they can at the hospital, but if you're walking around by yourself, typically there's something that I'm not familiar with all of the devices.
What's the finger device called? The one for the pulse ox.
Do you mean sort of a...
Oh, that gives you your pulse.
The feedback, the...
pulse ox. Pulse ox.
Yeah.
So let me get it straight. If you have...
Biofeedback.
If you have a... if your heart is going real fast, sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's not good. When you're exercising, you want to get your heart up, and there's a formula. I know there's a formula.
Mm-hmm.
240 minus your age... divided by the square root of pi, and something like that. Simple formula. So there's a formula for it. For how hard, you want to get your heart working at 40 to 80% of its capacity. You want it up there. You don't want it to be too quiet.
Right.
But if you're doing something like making love, and your heart is going fast, are you going to stop? You know, should you stop because your heart's beating fast?
Again, I think that probably not, but I think that you would have some parameter, you would have been educated to some degree. These are questions to ask your doctor and know what your limitations are. I can't answer that question because I think you really need to work with your doctor on that. It's so individual.
But what if he doesn't want to have sex with you?
I think
he's going to observe you.
But I would say that going back to the psychological, that I would suggest that the fear itself is harmful. So you're better off if you can, if you're going to engage in sexual activity, don't bring the fear into it. You know, I have patients sometimes who tell me they're afraid to go to sleep at night. They're afraid that they won't wake up. So there is fear after a heart attack. That's very normal, actually. It's normal to have the fear. But then to educate yourself as much as you possibly can, if there are meetings, if the American Heart Association, I mean, there's all sorts of information out there.
I know part of what they teach you things like even toilet habits, you know, bearing down.
Mm-hmm.
If you're constipated, is not such a good idea because it could be the last thing you ever do.
All kinds of things, and again, you don't want activity that's going to raise your blood pressure so much. Of course, many times the patient is on a medication that will prevent that pressure from going too high, which is protective.
Let's talk about the medications just a little bit. Knowing that you are number one, not a physician,
mm-hmm.
and number two, you then But from your experience, the primary ones are the beta blockers and
that would be one.
The ACE inhibitors.
That would be another. There are many, many, many medications that are available and prescribed for cardiac patients depending on their individual circumstances. But
and you're a strong advocate of course, nutrition and
very much so. Very much so.
And a healthy lifestyle.
Very much so. Very
even
much
more so.
Well, I really believe that. Again, it's about educating yourself as much as you can so that you can see as time goes on there may be alternatives that you can involve yourself with that might help the hypertension. I believe in both. It's more complementary medicine as opposed to one or the other. So they agree with each other.
The heart shouldn't be a mystery to you. Learning the physiology of the heart is such an important thing, and nowadays mm-hmm. it's so available. You know?
I think one has to be careful because I sometimes see fear in the patient's eyes when you start talking about, to some degree, they need to know, but I think you don't want people to be frightened. So if they know that, for example, they can have a clot or throw a clot and how that can happen if they're stressed, there needs to be some balance in how they understand that they're not going to just walk out and suddenly have a heart attack. You know, you don't want to scare people, but you do want to educate them. And it's a balance again. It's a tough balance sometimes.
Do you recommend any particular websites related to cardiac psychology?
Cardiac psychology. There are, I don't know of any that are, that's why we
started
ours.
There are very few cardiac psychologists in the world, aren't there?
In the country, yes.
In the country, for sure.
Very few. Very few.
I know of Robert Allen, right?
Yes.
Didn't he write a book called Heart and Mind?
Yes.
Very successful book.
Yes.
And once again, the website that we're looking at.
www.thegoodheart.com.
Which you can always get by looking at my website, thepositivemind.com, and clicking on it, and you could find it under Friends.
And it was started because most of the sites that you go to, whether it's WebMD or wherever you go, are related or dealing primarily with lowering your cholesterol, making sure you exercise, getting your hypertension in line, but very little. Maybe there's just a tiny bit mentioning how to deal with stress or in depth. And so we try to go into that a little bit more fully.
Optimism versus pessimism, and what kind of movies should you be watching?
A good question. You're better off watching comedies, actually. There was a study not too long ago showing changes in blood flow. When people watched a comedy, there was an increase of blood flow by about 20%, 20-plus percent, and a decrease in blood flow to the heart with a serious movie, and I think it was Saving Private Ryan that people were watching. So,
what was the comedy?
I don't remember.
You know, because it's so hard to find a comedy nowadays.
Do you remember Norman Cousins many years ago?
Sure.
He was a wonderful man, but he had developed a very unusual, I think, an autoimmune disease and wasn't given much hope. And he rented a bunch of old Marx movies in the hospital and had a full recovery at that time. I think, of course, he since has passed away. But anything that makes you laugh is going to help you. It's not the whole answer, but it is.
What do you think it does? What do you think the laughter physically does?
Relaxes the upper body, allows, again, for greater blood flow. And what does blood flow mean? But more oxygen, both to the brain and to the heart and to the lungs. And relaxing the arteries, the lining of the arteries, when they're relaxed and not constricted, there's no turbulence in the blood flow. The blood flow is going to be even and balanced as it should be.
So if you have somebody in your family who had a heart attack, it's good to sneak up behind them and tickle them.
Well, perhaps. If they don't get scared, but it could be a good thing, yes.
No, but the laughter itself.
Yes.
Laughter is kind of a...
Look at beautiful things. Look at beautiful things. Pay attention to beautiful things. I usually recommend that people limit the amount of time they spend watching the news. We need to keep informed, but too much news and too much television. Television's actually depressing. So
if you had a choice, and I want to talk about Saving Private Ryan or something like that, there are the people who are already depressed are going to find Saving Private Ryan appealing because somehow it goes along with their system.
Very good point.
And this is part of a survival mechanism. The body is using depression. Mm-hmm. Right, because it believes it needs you to be depressed to live longer. So what a mistake the body's making. You know, the engineer of the body is saying, we want you depressed because this is going to be your survival mechanism.
I don't know if the body is saying we want you to be depressed, but the body might be saying, might force you to slow down with a depression, but you don't want to stay in a depressed state for any length of time, because depression itself, for many, many reasons, is unhealthy. For many reasons. I mean, there are just huge losses in our country every year, both economically and psychologically and physically, because of depression. Enormous loss. Loss in days of work, loss in monies, loss in productivity. So we don't want to stay depressed. But if it tells you that it's time for you to take better care of yourself, if you can see it as a cue, and then work on getting rid of it, it might be seen that way.
You know, depression's a little bit like smoking was a few years ago. A few years ago, you know, if you smoked a cigarette, everybody's saying, look, you got to give it up, you got to give it up, you got to give it up. Finally, people believed it, and most people gave up the cigarette, with a few holding on. Depression now is so treatable
that
to see somebody who's depressed, it makes you wonder, you know. You say, come on, we've got, I know you feel frustrated. I know you feel there's nothing you could do about it. I know you believe nothing's going to help you. And then I hear people saying, I don't want to take medication.
Yes.
I would rather be depressed and have a heart attack and die early than take medication. Right. But in effect, depression is a medication, isn't it?
Well, I think that some may not want to take medication because there's a sense that they'll lose control. And you may already feel that you've lost control when you're depressed. So I'm not saying everyone, but there are people who are fearful of having some sort of chemical in their brain, thinking that this will be a loss of control. So they will avoid medication at all costs.
A loss of what kind of control?
Well, control of themselves, control of their mind, control of their lives.
So depression, in many ways, depression is a form of control. It's like suicide is a form of control.
People who are depressed are hanging on. They're holding on with all their might.
They're
holding on with all their might.
I'm in my little cave, and I'm going to be in my cave, and I'm at least in this cave. I have some control. So the powerlessness that many people feel in the world gets kind of beat out by being, at least I'll hold on to my depression. And I've met depressed people who, if you try to make a dent into them and you try to do something with it, they're holding on for dear life.
They might not believe that anything will change. You know, that's the hopelessness of depression and the helplessness. They might really have a belief that they carry that nothing they do will make a difference. That's another problem.
And therefore, there must be a belief that there's something broken inside. And I find the people who are the ones who believe that nothing can make a difference are ones who on some level feel that they are being punished for something they did.
Very possibly, yes.
Somehow therapy sometimes has to get underneath it and say, why do you think you deserve this punishment?
Right. Cognitive therapy, in using cognitive therapy, sort of asks people to suspend some of their beliefs and behave as if they don't believe that belief in some way.
How would you treat my depression?
Well, if someone were to say to me that nothing I do makes a difference, I would ask them to give me examples of things they do. For example, if they enjoy watching a comedy, for example, how did they feel when they watched the comedy? And they might say, I felt pretty good for a while, but then I was depressed again. So it sort of disputes their own assumption that nothing will make a difference. And usually you can find those windows in a person's day. So you might ask someone to keep a chart of moments when they feel a little bit less depressed. Now, some people will come back with an empty chart. Then it's a matter of trying to help that person see if they are minimizing or diminishing the value of the things that they're doing, because that's something we do, or trivializing. Yeah, I had a good time, but it really didn't matter. You see, so they're not able to observe or hold on to that moment because they're minimizing the good. And that's another distortion in their thinking, which we try to help them overcome. So there are many ways.
Austin Hayes, you're a beautiful person. You know, I just get the sense that if somebody sat with you, they wouldn't want to be depressed because they want to join you in your world.
Oh,
you know, I think
thank
it's important.
You.
I think when a therapist is depressed, it's very hard for them to treat depressed people.
I would think it might be. I think it's very helpful to have experienced deep life, you know, sadness and happiness and anger and every emotion, so you can certainly identify with what your patient is feeling, but nevertheless, if you were depressed, I think it might be difficult to treat someone at the moment. Mm. Could be.
Austin Hayes, who's from the age of 15, been interested in this heart work and work of people with this, and now I hear you're going up to the Adirondacks.
Yes.
Is that true? What are you going to be doing up there?
Well, I will be starting to see patients. I do currently see patients in the cardiac unit there for a support group once a month and have been doing that for maybe 5 years in Lake Placid, New York. But I will be starting to see patients individually, a small practice in Lake Placid as well in December, starting next month.
So you're saying to us mm-hmm. that you, a heart specialist, mm-hmm. are going to be living a good piece of your life.
Yes.
In Lake Placid?
Actually, Essex, New York. Yes, thank you.
How perfect.
Thank you. Lake Placid, yes.
Lake Placid, Essex. Well, I'm not going to go any further with that. This is Austin Hayes. He's a remarkable person. Clinical psychologist, specializes in cardiac psychology. I want to thank you for being with
us. Thank you. I enjoyed it so much.
We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. If you want a copy of today's program, you can go to thepositivemind.com or you can go to WBAI.org and you could listen to it. And we'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. Bye-bye now.
When in the empty city a siren blasts through the stop, go, then gone. The city returns to humming just below Middle C. An unsettled heart, maybe next door. The heavy-footed neighbor up at all hours, shuffling across the floor. In contrary motion, the light coming through the window, the color of Saturday with Sunday's face, makes the pattern on the wall in the bedroom itself becomes something else. Like art and me.